So firstly, it's a great pleasure for me to be here. This place is so inspiring. I've only spent a day here, but already walking around and stuff, it's really, really amazing. It's a great honor, and I thank the organizers and for being invited here. Extremely grateful. And I'm happy that you're all here, and thank you for your attention and for your interest in coming here. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about the causal properties of evaporating black holes. So I'm not a physicist, so I don't. I'm not claiming that this is the right way that these things work. I'm just considering mathematical resources of Lorentzian geometry, and I'm asking, what can I say about these spacetimes? Should I restrict myself only to Lorentzian geometry? And by that, I mean a Lorentzian manifold, paracompact Hausdorff of dimension greater or equal to 4. And the theorems that I'll be describing are true for a metric differentiability class of C3 on the manifold. So that's the background structure. But before I get onto the theorems and describing the results, I'm going to talk about something before that to introduce these notions, and I'm going to talk about the causal ladder. So I'm sure this will be very familiar to many of you, and so I apologize in advance if my brief review of the causal ladder is something you've seen before. Perhaps you can use this opportunity to catch up on some sleep, but for those that don't know about the causal ladder, then I'm going to be introducing this, and there'll be lots of diagrams. I'll be going through what that means. The second part of the talk, I'm going to talk about some old results that are due to Bob Garoche and that were essentially based on a reformulation of arguments appearing before in 79 by Kodama. So first is 79 Kodama, and then 83-84 Garoche. And basically, the paper in which the later results appear was actually written by Bob Wald, and it appeared in a contribution to Bryce DeWitt. It was an anniversary contribution to that. So if you want to look at that paper, you can find that in that volume. Ask me later, I can give you the references. I think this is an undervalued paper. I think it's a very beautiful paper. Of course, it's a mathematical, you know, physicist talking, so from the physics point of view, there's surely to be debates. But anyway, it's the opinion of Bob Wald. And I actually talked to Bob recently, and he told me that essentially he has the same view now as he did back then. Hasn't changed his opinion. And then finally, I'm going to talk about new results. And that'll be the punchline, and that'll be the third part of the talk. So let's get started. So the causal ladder is essentially a list of definitions, each one subsequently stronger than the next, that captures some property about the causal structure of the space-time. So I'll start with global hyperbolicity, which of course very familiar. Then causal simplicity. You'll see, as I list these definitions, you'll see that some mathematicians have had some fun coming up with these names. Causal simplicity, then causal continuity, that'll play an important role in this talk, then stable causality, then strong causality, then we'll have distinguishing, then non-total imprisonment, so a curve is totally imprisoned if it's inextendable within a compact set.
I mean, I think we mostly don't know these things.
So yeah, I'm gonna describe. So the next board, I'm gonna draw pictures for each of these. Well, for the ones that matter mostly. After non-total imprisonment, there's causality. Then there's chronology, and my personal favorite, there is non-totally vicious. Oh, that's my.
Which is stronger than non-total imprisonment.
Sorry, what was that?
That's
actually Carter. So, by the way, just this particular definition is going to play no role in this talk, but I'm going to state it because it's a funny one. So, What this says is that I of plus minus p is not equal to m for all p. So basically, it hasn't got this very weird pathological structure. So if you want a picture for it, you could consider, Minkowski spacetime, two-dimensional, that you've identified along some horizontal edges. So now the topology is S1 cross R. Notice then, where S1 is reference to the time direction, notice then that a time-like curve will curve and it's going to cover the whole tube space-time. So these space-times are totally vicious. Anyway. So those are the definitions. And throughout the talk, I'm going to be talking mainly about global hyperbolicity, causal continuity, distinguishing. And so you can ignore the other ones for now. I'm just listing them. There's actually infinite number of sub-definitions within the definitions. They're called infinite sub-ladders. Roger Penrose kind of thought of those, and they've been developed. And from the point of view of Lorentzian geometry, if you're a Lorentzian geometer, the causal ladder is your bread and butter. It's really something you study a lot, and you know examples that go in each direction. And then people have a lot of fun lowering differentiability classes and seeing whether all the implications work out, the counterexamples work out, and everything. It's a business, the causal ladder. anyway, so global hyperbolicity, of course, we all know that. That's just domain of dependence is M for some S acting as my Cauchy surface. So I'm not going to dwell on that one too much. Just draw this representative picture. Number two, so that's when J plus minus P is closed for all P, and the spacetime is causal. Now, a spacetime which is not causally simple will simply be Minkowski spacetime with a point excised, simply because then, if I'm missing a point, I can consider the future of some other point Q, and then notice that my null geodesic, which was the boundary of my future, cannot be extended through this point. And so J plus is now not closed. So Minkowski spacetime with a point removed is not causally simple. My third one, this is going to be key for the talk, so I'm going to define it a little bit more carefully. My third one is causal continuity. Now, that was 1974, Hawking and Sachs. So it's a lovely article. I recommend those interested to chase it up. So a spacetime, so mg is causally continuous if it is distinguishing, which I'm going to define later on, and the following equivalent conditions hold. So what are the equivalent conditions? They're only equivalent for the case of causal of this type of spacetime, for continuous spacetime. So one is outer continuity holds. I'm going to define what that is. Or two, it's going to be I'm going to first define this one, and then I'll define this one. But basically, reflectivity is going to be the other one. Okay, so maybe I'll just keep it like that. Okay, so what does outer continuity mean? Outer continuity, so one, I'm going to draw another. Oh, I shouldn't have said one, I should have said A and B. So outer continuity is the claim that for any point P, this will be a little bit wordy, but hopefully the diagrams will be useful. For any point P, any neighborhood U of P, sufficiently small, then if I consider the causal future of P, and I consider some compact set K, which is going to be contained in M cross the closure of I of P. So basically, it's not in the future of P, and it's not even close to the future of P. It's really outside. then the spacetime is outer continuous at P if for such a, for any such K, I can find a neighborhood such that any Q in this neighborhood also has the property that I of closure of Q does not involve P, not involve K. So that's the definition of outer continuity at P. And if the spacetime is outer continuous everywhere, then it's, so at every point, then it's outer continuous. The whole spacetime is outer continuous. So basically, what that mean, I mean, intuitively, what that means is that I have a point, I have the future, I can consider something outside the future, and if I just move a little bit from that point, I'm still not including the thing that was outside. And that'll be true for any compact set K outside the closure of I of P and any sufficiently small neighborhood from that point P. So that's outer continuity. That these are equivalent is non-trivial. That was the proof of the main theorem in that paper. Reflectivity is, so this was A, now B. Reflectivity is much, much more intuitive. Reflectivity just says, I consider some point P and the future I of P. Now consider some point Q in the future, so that Q is inside I of P. Reflectivity holds if for any such two points related, it also holds that I minus of P is contained within I minus of Q. So you can see the why it was called reflectivity. You can kind of mirror image them. Okay, so causal continuity is a spacetime that's distinguishing and that's either A or B, which in the case of causal continuity becomes equivalent.
And what's distinguishing?
I'm just about to go. I'm just about to define. So I'm actually going to define a few more just to give us a little bit of an idea. So distinguishing is that if I or minus of P equals I plus or minus of Q, then in fact P equals Q. So one can consider, for example, the Taub-Nut spacetime, where my light cones are rotating and coming back again, and then consider any point on the closed null geodesics, and have two points here. This is the past light cone here. Notice that a point here will have the same past, but in fact, it's not the same point. So that's not a distinguishing spacetime. Anyway. I want to just define one or two more because I think they'll give us a nice intuition of what's going on. So for a stable causality, I'm sure you all know this one. So stable causality is the requirement that I'm not going to give you the full definition because it's a little bit technical. It'll take us too much time, which I don't want to go through. But basically, it means that if I open the light cone slightly such that I produce a larger light cone, namely one that includes this one such that all null vectors here become time-like in this larger light cone, then by doing so, I don't include any closed causal curves. So namely, this thing doesn't happen. That's stable causality. A nice thing about stable causality is that if a spacetime is stably causal, you can define a global time function. It's very nice. I'm not going to define strong causality because it doesn't play any role here. I've already defined distinguishing. Non-total imprisonment, I said it earlier, right? Non-total imprisonment just means that an inextendable causal curve doesn't get trapped in some compact set forever. It doesn't have to be a closed time-like curve. It can do whatever, but this doesn't happen. The non-total imprisonment is like that. Finally, the space-time is causal means that there are no closed causal curves. Chronological, it's the same except replace causal with time-like, and non-totally vicious I defined earlier. Okay, so this is the causal ladder. I don't want to spend any more time really on the causal ladder because we've got a lot to get through. So now I'm going to talk about a theorem which I appeared, as I said, in 1979 and then was rewired in 1984 by Bob Garoche and by Bob Wald. Okay. So the theorem is as follows, and I'm going to present the theorem, and then what I'm going to do is draw a picture to express what the theorem says. So A, S1, and S2 are partial Cauchy surfaces. So There are space-like hypersurfaces without edge. Two, J of K intersection with S2 has compact closure where K is defined as S1 minus the past domain of dependence of S2 cross S1. And I'll draw a picture of why that's relevant. And then three is there exists a point P which is not contained in the union of the future and the past of S2. So these are the premises. The conclusion then is that 1 plus 2 plus 3 imply that M not globally hyperbolic. So this is the theorem. OK, why is it a nice theorem? Here's why. No, I need this one in front of that one. So I'm going to rub out this one. OK. So the idea behind the theorem was to show that evaporating black hole spacetimes are not globally hyperbolic. That was what the theorem was trying to do. And I'll draw a few pictures now to try and convince you that that's a suitable interpretation of what the theorem's trying to do. Of course, the full theory, we don't really know what these evaporating things are, so we just consider them from the point of view of this talk and the work presented. That's just what you might say if you restricted yourself to Lorentzian geometry. Of course, I'm very happy to discuss with people working in quantum gravity, which is a field I don't work in, to tell me why this is suitable, not suitable, wrong, right, whatever. So anyway, here's the standard Penrose diagram people draw. Oh. And we can now think of S1 and S2 as follows. This will be S1. This will be S2. Notice then that the past domain of dependence of S2 is everything here, so that this guy here is S1 cross past domain of dependence of S2. And notice then that the set K as defined becomes this guy. This is K. Now, what the condition says, condition number two, is that if I consider this diagram, I'm going to draw it yet again. I have my S1 like this, have my S2 like that. I've defined some set here, K. What this says is that the future of K, when I intersect it with S2, has compact closure. So this guy has compact closure. And essentially, that there is just a point P which is not in the causal past of S2. So this is condition three I'm talking about now. That there's a point P which is not in the future or in the past of S2 simply means there's a black hole. Because then, of course, I can consider a point P inside. And here I'm assuming that once this point is in the black hole, it's not visible from some later time slice. So this is the Penrose diagram, but I'd like to emphasize that this theorem doesn't have, you don't need this Penrose diagram. I mean, this theorem is just a theorem. Penrose diagram that people draw is just a nice way of showing this theorem. So the theorem basically tells you that for any such spacetime that satisfies 1, 2, and 3, you cannot find a Cauchy surface for the spacetime. OK, now I prefer to draw another picture. This will be the last picture I draw for this theorem, but I think it's worthwhile. So I consider an evaporating black hole, from the point of view of this theorem, to be some unknown strange region here. This is my S2, this is my S1. And then I'm just going to redraw what the theorem says. So everything outside here will be the past domain of dependence of S2 cross S1. And so the set K will now be this. You could think of it as the causal shadow, right? And then you can consider the future and its intersection with S2. And this is the thing that has compact closure. So just to give you some feeling for what's going on, if, for example, I don't have this picture in mind when I'm talking about evaporating black holes, if, in fact, they leave remnants, singularities that are visible, such like, then the notion that the future of this set is going to have compact closure with S2 is going to fail. For example, if I had some singularity going here, this set, though its boundary is compact, as I go near the singularity, I'm not going to find something that has compact closure. So this is really based on a certain interpretation of what happens because of black hole evaporation. Anyway, that's the theorem. OK, that's all I wanted to cover for that theorem. It's quite important that this theorem is, because the new results that I'm going to be talking about are based basically on a strengthening of this theorem. So it's, I think it's a good point right now to ask if anybody has any questions regarding this theorem or how they feel about it or if they don't like it or whatever.
Sure. So if instead of the singularity, there's another future region which is not visible from Sky Plus, does that contradict the conditions of this theorem?
No, I don't think so, no.
So
Could you? I mean, I'm not sure I understood fully the question. Can you say it again?
So the squiggly line, which is usually said to be where the singularity.
Sure.
So erase that.
Okay, erase that so that now it's just some.
Now consider the causal future of that.
Yeah.
That line as disjoint from the space, it's disjoint from S2. It's not visible from S2. Not visible from the prior class. That's a solution to. That's a hypothesis. About how it resolves itself. So you still have your region K. It still has compact closure.
Yeah, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. So in fact, in the theorem, I'll be presenting the assumption that this guy is singular doesn't matter. So all I need is that there is some that the future of this point is not visible from Scry. So for example, in the Kerr space time. When I pass through the horizon, then I'm not in the causal future of that. And when I pass through the Cauchy horizon, I'm neither in the past of Scry. So I don't need to assume that this is in fact singular. The theorem will still hold.
Whereas in a black hole evaporating to a white hole picture, that is visible. P is visible from Scry.
In which case assumption 3 would not be suitable. There may still be, though, some possibly a way of getting the same result of non-global hyperbolicity, but it won't be with this particular theorem, but it may be that some other theorem might do it. So need not be singular, pace, white hole, possible scenario. In which case, I don't know how that works.
Well, no, if it's a white hole, it is visible from Scry.
Exactly, yeah. So I'm not assuming.
Maybe the universe would be not visible from Scry.
OK, yeah, nice.
And then the conclusion would be that this classical space time with the baby universe is not visible.
Exactly.
Do we care?
Sorry?
Is that what we're having? Behind this is the assumption that we only believe in space-time as a problem.
No, that's not so. No. I mean, if you're working in PDEs these days and you're trying to prove strong cosmic censorship, sure, you're trying to show that generically the maximal globally hyperbolic development of any initial data is in fact inextendable, and therefore we live in a globally hyperbolic universe. But this is not some assuming any of that. This is just a theorem about causal structure. So. I'm not trying to hold on to global hyperbolicity in any way, and I'm not trying to say, you know, I'm not. I have no eggs in that basket. There's no. Yeah.
Couple of questions. One is, how important is to take the word globally hyperbolic in a very strict sense? So I'm thinking that there are very reasonable space times which, in the strictest sense, are not globally hyperbolic. But in a causal sense, our global hyperbolic can mediate a change of topology from one spatial topology to another. You have a cobordism going from one to another, and you can put on it a Lorentzian metric, which is almost everywhere Lorentzian, has all the nice causal properties, but degenerates to zero at one point. In the strict definition, that wouldn't count as globally hyperbolic. But I would regard that as a perfectly nice space-time. So I'm just wondering, you know, how delicate is
so
the result depending on, would the, you know, if you were to allow that as globally hyperbolic, would this theorem still go through?
So I have not thought about that. I'll think about that as the talk, and maybe at the end of the talk I'll have thought of something. I, off the top of my head, I cannot think exactly of. I mean, I don't know exactly the character.
Such a spacetime would not be just the product of R or some interval with a three-dimensional topology.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how to answer your question, but I can say that, first of all, there are many spacetimes which are not globally hyperbolic in the strict sense, but that permit uniqueness of global evolution. So that's one thing to bear in mind. So it may be, for example, that these spacetimes which are not globally hyperbolic in the strict sense do in fact allow for unique global evolution. Now, I don't know if that's true because I don't know precisely what the class of spacetime is you're considering. And then I don't know, there are theorems which forbid topology change, and their assumptions are very strong. They're rather weak, and the conclusions are quite strong. So that might be something to think about. But I don't know how to answer the full details of your question.
Yeah, those theorems will, we can come back to this probably. I don't want to divert your talk. Those theorems will not, they will technically forbid this kind of space-time, but I think not for a good reason. Because they demand everywhere a Lorentzian signature, whereas here the metric is vanishing one point.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Structure is, anyway, but I wanted to ask, can you help us with the intuition why, in two, why we want the domain, the past domain of dependence, exactly? I mean, why is that the right thing to look at?
So,
guide us through the picture or something, so.
So why is that? Yeah. To be honest with you, I think what happened was that. There's an interesting historical point here. Kodama basically came up with the first version of this theorem, and he actually didn't assume things that were like that. He assumed a more general kind of context. But then he showed that basically, and his conclusion with that was that any space-time that satisfies those premises has to be globally hyperbolic. But then his argument for evaporation was that in one of the assumptions of his theorem, you need the disappearance of a trapped region. You need some S2 which is not intersecting any trapped regions. And that screws up one of the assumptions of the theorems, and if you buy the other ones, then you must have non-global hyperbolicity. So then Guerroche looked at sort of the theorem by Kodama and rewired it in a kind of simpler way to get the conclusion more directly, and he came up with this set with the set K that was defined as such. The proof works that way, and I don't know if I can give you any better intuitive explanation of why to pick that set for now. The proof certainly works, and it, when you draw this Penrose diagram, it kind of seems clear that, you know, you might want to consider this set as everything kind of happening outside being more or less described by a typical kind of causal structure, it does seem strange at first, and then the more you think about it, I think the less you worry about why. I mean, yeah. Sorry, I it's not a very satisfactory answer, but that's the best I can do. Maybe we can talk about why this is a good condition to pick in the first place.
Do you happen to remember how Kodama's original, what his original set of hypotheses were?
Sure. He has a very similar type of set, but he considers the closure of this guy, the closure of K. And then he also assumes that DS.
It's the same K. It's the first Cauchy surface.
It's the same K. It's essentially the same.
Dependence of the second one removed. Is that right?
Yeah.
So he considers the same K.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah.
So that won't answer, that won't clarify in itself why we should consider K, because he just started with it also.
Sure. No, the theorem works this way, and sure, why is it a good thing to consider? I'm not sure, but
the question is why, why does this capture our intuitive idea of an evaporating black hole?
Sure.
That's really the question.
Yeah, that's a great question. All I can do is present the way I think about it is that if I draw enough pictures, like these ones on the bottom board of these two slices, and if I draw these Penrose diagrams people like to draw, then I look at those pictures and I say to myself, well, in fact, you know, K isn't such a bad set to consider, because it kind of measures, you know, what you can predict from S2 in a sense, right?
Retrodiction, sure.
So in a sense, it kind of gives me the information later on from some slice. And I want to subtract that from what I can initially predict, and that's going to be the S1 slice. So that's my vague intuition why you consider K, but is that a good argument? I don't know. Are there any other questions about this theorem? Okay, so I'm going to rub off, I'm not going to rub off this, because this is important for our idea of what's going on, but I'm going to rub off this one. Okay, so essentially the result that I'm going to be describing is that if you like these assumptions and you slap a boundary on the spacetime, either in the form of a space-like null or time-like boundary, and you do this in the perfectly usual sense a la Penrose, modulo slightly more sophisticated versions of that idea, but basically the same idea. And you assume another condition on null geodesics, then you're able to prove that from 1, 2, and 3, you can get a lot more conclusions out. And I'm going to list those conclusions and state the theorem. So my scry is going to be defined as where M embeds into M tilde via conformal factor satisfying conditions one, two, and three, which I can give, but they're technical details that won't matter for the importance of the theorem. A nice aspect of this theorem that I'm going to be describing is that, in fact, scry can be anything you like. It can be null, space-like, or time-like. The idea was to cover all kinds of boundaries. So that's A. B, scry plus, union of alpha of the scry pluses maybe composed of uniformly time-like, null, or space-like components. The idea being that flat, ds, and ads are all cases that I'll be able to cover. Okay, and C, which is going to be the main assumption now. C, I'm sure we're going to debate about it, because I'm sure some of you will have problems with C. Certainly, I had problems with C, but it turns out that it's what enabled me to prove the theorem, so I just bought it. So C is the condition that for any null geodesic, it's complete and contained within the domain of outer communication, which in this case I'm defining as the intersection of scry minus with the causal past of scry plus. For any null geodesic that's complete outside the black hole, intersects with scry. So what that means is that if I'm a null geodesic and I'm complete outside the black hole, then I'm going to reach the boundary. Now, you
mean it meets both of them, or at least one of them?
So yeah, so I'm assuming both. I'm assuming both.
It's both of them.
Well, meets, so yes, meets both. Although when I state the theorem, there'll be a number of conclusions. And in fact, I'll make the remark that you'll only require half of this assumption for some of the conclusions. OK, so why is this reasonable? OK, so first of all, in Schwarzschild or Kerr, it's false. That's one thing we'd like to say. And why is it false? Well, if I consider the black hole, which kind of looks like this, the event horizon, say, then it's, maybe I should draw this a little taller. Then if I'm an orbiting null geodesic, for example, in Schwarzschild, r equals 3m, then in fact, I'm orbiting, and I don't reach scry, though I can be complete. Now, why my assumption basically amounts to saying that when the black hole disappears, these would-be orbiting null geodesics actually get released, and they can fly off to null infinity. So essentially, if this is my black hole that's evaporating, and these are my S1 and S2, and these are my scry plus and scry minus, then essentially I'm assuming that something which would have been orbiting actually ends up being released when the black hole is no longer. That's the assumption. We can all say, is that right? Is that wrong? Is it good? Is it bad? I don't know. It's a discussion we may have. But that was the assumption. Any would-be orbiting null geodesic ends up escaping once the black hole is no longer. OK. So then, what's the theorem? OK. So the theorem,
Are there any theorems that you know of that would lead to this conclusion? Like there's no horizons and blah, 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 and then?
So I mean, there are many ways you can engineer this. So for example, I mean, one thing I thought about for a while was that this will in fact be true if for any compact set outside any possible event horizon, if there is one, then the space-time is non-totally imprisoning. And if we remember our causal ladder, ooh, I rubbed it out. But the causal ladder, remember that non-total imprisoning, can I write on this? So remember that non-total imprisoning implied causality, but was implied by distinguishing. And so, in fact, non-total imprisonment lies rather low down the causal ladder. And so if it's true that for any compact set within the larger space-time M tilde, where now my compact set goes all the way here in M tilde, then I can go to this larger space-time M tilde, and that'll be true. Or I can also assume something else. I can say that there's no violations of causality or of total imprisonment near enough the black hole. Or I can engineer this failing. For example, if I consider a black hole like this that's evaporating or something, and I consider some compact region here, and I consider conformally rescaling this compact region here such that this guy goes to infinity sufficiently fast, then I can be a null geodesic that's complete here, but that doesn't get to scry. So I'm ruling out those things. So that's why this assumption is quite has these properties.
Is it ruled out, for example, where is the closed innermost circular state, whatever it is? I mean, there's it's at 3/2 of the Schwarzschild radius, right? Isn't
yeah.
that it?
3m, r equals 3m for short.
Yeah, but if I have 3 halves of the tree. So is something ruling out, for example, having a fluid star that would be a little bigger than, you know, would be, have no horizon, it would be a little bigger than a black hole, but still smaller than 3m. It's really spherically symmetric. I'm not sure anything.
Just to clarify, right? So there are all sorts of ordinary matter configurations that would violate your assumption.
So why? Yeah, could you explain that to me?
just in the sense that you could have a null GD6 which just go around, and you have some matter configuration which is bigger than its Schwarzschild horizon, and yet you have light orbits just circle around indefinitely.
Sure. I mean So my condition is not about. It's not about stars. The condition is trying to say if it's a black hole that evaporates. So if it's a black hole that evaporates, I'm assuming that, the picture I have in mind is something like Schwarzschild or Kerr in vacuum.
Yeah, you imagine, if you imagine that you're basically left with empty space in some rough sense, then okay, everything goes away and I'm okay.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't, then it doesn't.
Yeah, but then again, I wouldn't consider applying this condition if there was matter outside my black hole, right? Why would such a black hole evaporate? If it's a black hole like this. Sorry?
I think it's just a technical problem.
Uh-huh.
Suppose that there's a black hole that evaporates here, but over there in the next galaxy, there's one of these highly compact stars.
Uh-huh.
And it has these closed circular orbits around it.
Uh-huh.
Does that invalidate the proof?
So
you say it's kind of irrelevant physically, but
yeah. Well, no. So.
Because there'd be something in the domain of outer communication.
Sure. Yeah. No. I think so. If I have a black hole here, and it has an orbiting null geodesic, and then this guy evaporates, and then this guy just goes, it was going to go to Scry, but there's some compact star here which persists forever because it's not evaporating, right? And then it gets trapped, it doesn't reach Scry, then this particular condition fails, and sure. But in fact, you can prove the theorem. You can still prove the theorem, because what you can do is you can put your Scry here. So the actual details of this condition is just that for that black hole, those null geodesics which were trapped end up escaping. The proof of the theorem doesn't depend on the asymptotics on this boundary actually being, yeah, in a way. So it's kind of a quasi-local. I'm doing this, right? I'm taking a black hole and I'm actually putting a boundary here. So. Yeah, so if I now put my Scry here, then this other compact object violates this condition. But actually, the proof doesn't require that. I can have this anywhere. So long as, it's not. Yeah.
And what does this condition say about geodesics inside the horizon?
It doesn't say anything about those.
So those could be continued and never reach Scry.
Sure.
So again, so fine.
Because they're not in the dock.
Yeah, I need to say.
Sorry?
Not in the dock. Those would be complete and never reach Scry.
Yeah. But they in some other Scry.
They could hit some other Scry.
Yeah. But sure. But this, yeah, so this condition says it only applies to those geodesics which are in the dock of the relevant Scry. Okay, so let's actually state the theorem now. So the theorem then is this. So because I've rubbed out my causal ladder, but I've, I'm just going to remind us, I'm going to put the information of the causal ladder here again, because we really need it to visualize what's going on. So causal continuity is implied by causal simplicity and implies stable causality. And causal continuity is distinguishing plus either following equivalent condition. And these are either outer continuity, which I'm just going to draw as being this neighborhood here, such that for any compact set outside the future of this guy, I can always find a neighborhood U of P whose future doesn't include this compact set K. This was outer continuity. And reflectivity, easier to state and visualize. So that if something's in the future of something, its past includes the other past. OK, so these two are equivalent when the space-time is causally continuous. OK, good. So the theorem now says this. 1, 2, 3. And for 1, 2, and 3, I have these conditions in mind, plus A, B, and C. So sure, I'm assuming a lot. Then this implies, in fact, the following conclusions. MG is causally discontinuous. At best, stably causal. In fact, there's a refinement of this work which will use set theoretic characterizations of the causal ladder, but that's for another time. It's the project still ongoing as well. And furthermore, there exists incomplete null geodesics visible from points in some V such that V communicates with Doc. And I'll say roughly that that simply means naked null singularities. Okay, so what's going on here? So I'm taking these assumptions, which provide a way of capturing what's going on in these diagrams. I'm considering a conformal boundary, which I've slapped on at any kind of point, at any kind of region. I'm adding, furthermore, the condition that would-be orbiting null geodesics make it out to scry when they're no longer trapped, because the black hole is no longer. And then what I get is a stronger conclusion than this theorem, which merely told you that the space-time was not globally hyperbolic. Now I'm saying, actually, it gets worse. Not only they're not globally hyperbolic, they're not causally simple, and they're not causally continuous. So at best, they're stably causal, at best. Furthermore, there exists null, naked, null, incomplete geodesics.
Does that mean there exists at least one point where A or B breaks down, or A and B breaks down?
So I was just about to get onto this. So in fact, the theorem gives you a little bit more than what I've just said.
What does that last thing say?
There exists incomplete null geodesics visible from points in some V such that V communicates with the dot.
V is just an open set.
Yeah, absolutely.
Visible from V.
So
V is not in the domain of outer communication.
See, yeah, no, it is, it is. So yeah, it communicates. So it just means that V is in the dock and it can.
It's in the dock.
Yeah.
So there's some set in the domain of outer communication.
Yeah, I mean you could say. So you could say or simply from scry. So from scry plus, in fact from scry minus as well. So the thing is, again, this is the picture we have in mind. I'm saying that if I consider a point here, this point can communicate with the dock, in the dock. It can communicate with the future scry, and it can see this null incomplete, which is this null geodesic, which is incomplete. And the point of the way I phrased it, perhaps it was a little confusing, apologies for that. The way I was phrasing it was because you can have something that's visible from scry. But you want more than that. You want something that's visible from inside of scry, visible from the dock. I could see a naked singularity if I was here, but I want something stronger. I want to say I can see it if I'm just near the black hole. So that was the point of that thing. So let's come back to the question. So in fact, you can show Perhaps I'll keep going.
If you erase that, if you were going to erase that picture,
sorry.
How can it see the null geodesic? It doesn't look in this as if.
Yeah. So
it
I mean.
See the null geodesic.
Yeah. So by visible here, I mean, so if it's from the past scry, I'll mean that they're in the future light cone. And if they're from future scry, I'll mean that that these null geodesics are contained in the closure of the past.
Closure of the past.
Yeah. Okay, so the question was, can you get any more? I mean, there's a way of answering the question, which is basically you can show actually more than what I've just said, but I'm not going to state the whole thing. But you can show that basically there's a failure of reflectivity from any P on the future Cauchy horizon of S1. S1, this is the future Cauchy horizon. You can show that these two points, I should draw another picture for this. You can show that essentially, if this is S1 and this is S2, I've got some evaporating black hole here. Now, this is going to be my Cauchy horizon. And what you can show is that for any point here on this thing, P, then there's a failure of past reflectivity, where essentially what that means is that I can have two points, P and Q, like this, such that the past of P includes the past of Q, but in fact, the future of Q does not contain the future of P. And you can kind of see that, right? If I have a point here, and if I have a point here, then its past here is going to be contained in the past here, but its future is not going to contain the future of this guy.
Did you remove that point? That mythical point was the singularity is the right.
So I haven't removed it, but essentially, I mean. What do you mean? Sorry, I.
The horizon, the geodesic making the horizon to pass to that point is incomplete at that point.
Absolutely, yeah. So.
Is this that point? That point was always rather mythical, I think.
So the theorem tells you there's a failure of past reflectivity for all points lying on the future Cauchy horizon of S1. Space-time is therefore not causally continuous. At best, it's stably causal. But in fact, then once this theorem is proved, then it starts to get more interesting, because then we can start doing some more Lorentzian geometry on the thing, and we can start getting some more theorems out. So basically, the second part, I mean, I'm not going to go through this. This is for another time. Oh god, my time's running out. But basically, yeah, you can show that if a space. So then what's in the paper is that you consider space times that are stably causal, but causally discontinuous. And this is going to define a certain type of causal structure, right? That it sits at a certain place in the causal ladder. And then you can start getting theorems out. For example, one thing that's nice is that you can prove that this space time is not stationary. Of course, that seems rather obvious because the thing's evaporating, and you know, but you can actually prove it, so that's kind of nice. And you can prove a number of other things as well, but this is still work ongoing. The next directions for this is to kind of try and do this, but for more general mathematical characterizations of the causal ladder, possibly ones that could be recovered in some putative theory of quantum gravity. So just to deal with sets rather than to deal with futures and geodesics and Lorentzian manifold. But that's really work for the future. Anyway, thank you all for listening.
Yes, isn't there another way that assumption C could be violated, though? I mean, perhaps if you're assuming C, aren't you assuming that the black hole doesn't leave some sort of compact massive remnant or something like that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't know what the science of orbiting null geodesics around compact stars is, maybe the people that know this can clarify. But sure, I can imagine that C would be violated if there actually leaves some compact object that still traps these things. Sure, sure.
Since there's a little time, do you want to say something more about this set approach?
Yeah, so
you just...
yeah. So this set theoretic approach is very beautiful and interesting, and I don't know if it's going to lead to anything, but basically the point is that the causal ladder can be redefined within set theoretic notions. So what you do is you have some, you basically consider sets on M cross M, and M is now no longer a Lorentzian manifold. There are different ways you could do things. So there's two mathematicians who have kind of done some really beautiful work on this. One of them assumes that it's a metric space, but not anything more than that. And the other one assumes merely that some sprays are well defined. And I, to be honest with you, I haven't studied.
That sounds very smooth or something. I mean, that sounds very much like that's a manifold.
The other direction.
What?
It's the other direction from what you want to go.
Yeah, that seems like the other. Well, I don't know if it's going the other.
So I mean,
like, it's assuming a lot of.
So I mean, so you don't need a so the metric. So the first part is that you can have a C0 metric and do the causal ladder, and you can still have a lot of stuff. But of course, a C0 metric is still more or less more of a classical picture. But these set theoretic ways of doing the causal ladder, they don't involve the metric really. But to start defining things would take a lot of time. But basically, yeah, I'd like to. So there's something called Woolgar, Sorkin, and who else? Yeah. So there's something called K-causality, and basically that was shown to be equivalent to stable causality by Minguzzi. Yeah. So Minguzzi, I'm asking Minguzzi to try and help me out here. Basically, he knows set theoretic characterization, the causal ladder, very well. But basically, he's now written a paper that just came out in 2018, where he basically redoes the whole causal ladder with these set theoretic ideas, basically inspired from this work by Sorkin and by Woolgar. And basically, he's got a lot of new definitions. And one thing I'm playing around with is that there's a definition which sits between causal continuity and stable causality in the causal ladder called causally easy. And what that says is that the space-time is strongly, it's causally easy. And what that means is that strong causality, but in fact, this is not defined in terms of the Hausdorffness of the set theoretic characterization. So basically, it's if you're strongly causal, then the manifold topology is generated by the intersections of the past and the futures. This is very well known from Penrose. The idea was to now define the causal, to define strong causality via the property that what you think of as being the future in the past is Hausdorff, generates Hausdorff topology, and that J plus is transitive. J plus, that the closure of J plus is transitive. Now my bet, but this is a bet, is that in fact these spacetimes, if I characterize such spacetimes in a set theoretic way, that they're causally easy. It's a guess, but it's my bet. Now, if they're causally easy, then maybe you can start getting theorems about these spacetimes and understand different properties and such things. So that's really something for the future. I haven't really studied this in any kind of real detail, but whether or not evaporating black holes can be considered from this set theoretic characterizations as causally easy is the question I'd like to work on, for example.
I had a question, but maybe it's not a good You didn't give us any sense of the proofs of these two.
No.
Can you wave your hand and say,
yeah, sure.
Exactly how the proof
yeah, so the proof, yeah, I mean, the yeah, so, okay, so, sure. So the
can
proof.
I ask a question before you,
sorry, yeah.
What's your intuition? If I came along and said my intuition is that a classical picture of evaporating black hole space time is just, has the same topology as Minkowski space time, would you disagree? Does your theorem prevent me from believing that? In other words, if there's complete evaporation,
Can you repeat? I didn't.
So Avshikhar's picture, I think, because the Penrose diagram is the same as Minkowski.
Oh, that's
right.
Is that what you're? Yes.
Yeah, Avshikhar and Carlo Rovelli and company. There's some quantum. There's a black hole that evaporates a little bit. This quantum region, replacing the singularity, and then there's a transition to a white hole space-time. It all goes away and says bye bye and leaves you with Minkowski space in the future. Is there any impact on your theorem to somebody who would assert that that's what the physics is?
Well, I to be honest with you, I don't know. I need to think about this. Sorry, I can't answer in any neat way right now, but I have to think about that. I'm not very familiar with their work, but definitely that's something I need to think about. Sorry.
Okay.
So ideas for the proof. So the proof is actually not difficult because I'm assuming so much, right? Initially, what I wanted to do is prove the same conclusions just from 1, 2, and 3, and possibly even weaker than 1, 2, and 3. The problem with that is that because there are many ways for a space-time to get screwed up by causal structure, it's very hard identifying what, you know, it's hard working with not much. So basically, I had to assume these extra things, and these extra things kind of came naturally because they came naturally as what I needed for the proof to work. But basically, the proof is not hard. It's kind of standard Lorentzian geometry, so a few new lemmas, but not many. And then basically, you can show that there's a Cauchy horizon from the first part of the thing. That's already clear. But then by a standard property of Cauchy horizons, you know they're generated as a future Cauchy horizon. You know they're generated by past and extendable null-achronal curves. So once you've got that, you can consider a kind of sequence of limit curves. And basically, these limit curves, you want them to you want to find out what's the limit curve of that sequence of accumulating curve. What's the accumulating curve? And basically, you can show that it accumulates to a curve which has to be not closed. And that's, again, clear from 1, 2, and 3. And then basically, what you do is you consider a compact set defined as in the past of Scry, but not in the in the future of this guy. And then because it's visible from Scry, essentially this compact set is going to be inside any sufficiently small neighborhood from Q. So you use the equivalence of reflectivity and outer continuity for causally continuous spacetimes, and you say you assume reflectivity and you get a contradiction. Because by assuming reflectivity, if this guy is in the past, you know, if this guy is in the past of this guy, then this guy should contain this guy, and then you show that with the construction just defined, you have a contradiction. So the proof goes: assume reflectivity. I mean, the first bit is just like some standard lemmas of Lorentzian geometry. The second part is assume reflectivity. If it's causally continuous, that's equivalent to outer continuity. But then by picking a judiciously chosen compact set, you got a contradiction. So that's roughly the way the proof works. And then there's a second theorem, but I don't describe it here. And the second theorem is more local. So I do away with all these global assumptions, and I just consider I'm assuming in a way more, because I'm assuming that there's a past incomplete null geodesic that's going to be contained in the closure of I minus of P. And I assume by fiat that it's weakly visible. And by weakly visible, I define that by following a definition by Woolgar and by Galloway, where essentially the idea is that although it may not be in the closure of some point, that there's a set of points, that the net of points from which it's weakly visible accumulate to a limit point, and then you can kind of use that so it's weaker than simply a geodesic being in the past at some point. What's nice about this net that accumulate to some point which does have this guy in its closure is that once you've got this, then, well, you can start playing around with differentiability, make sure that things work out with lower differentiability, but also you can show that if this is true, then in fact, and this is not a hard lemma at all, then in fact it'll be visible from points in the future of this guy P. And that's what I meant by communicating with the doc, is that you assume that it's in the closure here, but then, well, that this accumulation sequence has a, that this net has an accumulation point, and then you can show actually it'll be visible from these points, even though it may not be, well, it'll be weakly visible from these points, even though it may not have been weakly visible from that point. And what you get by this quasi-local, this more local way of doing it, you get the same conclusions. You get a failure of causal discontinuity. You have a failure of causal. Yeah. So that's the second theorem. And then the third stuff, which I haven't talked about, is trying to do this without trying to weaken some assumptions and trying to, again, yeah, the next project, if I continue in this route, which I'd like to, would be to start doing things with sets.
Thanks, Martha, again.